I'm Brian, I'm an addict. I got a lot of stuff queuing up, basically. And I would like to thank the committee and Simon and Laura for a sterling chair. I can only really tell you about myself from a step four and a five kind of perspective, really. That's up until that point, I didn't know who I was, and I think even more importantly is that I didn't care who I was. I had very little interest in me and as a person. And what made me tick and what made me move and what made me say yes and what made me say no and what was driving me and what I was being driven from were all things that were a complete mystery to me. And I'd kind of had that the meeting. I'd come to my first meeting and I'd had that moment of clarity that we hear about. Very quickly went away in a flash. I mean, it was there and gone in a flash. But I knew that something was in the room that could, you know. But it wasn't until I did a four and a five that I started to actually find out who Brian is. And I kind of consequently, I found out that I was a bit of an addict quite a long time before I picked up drugs. And what came out in this step four and five was that I come from a very traditional working class family, and my mum and my dad, me and my brother, we lived in the top floor of this little house. It had no bathroom, an outside toilet, and it was in the middle of Islington, surrounded by, you know, all sorts of weird and wonderful, you know, like inner London is. And so I lived with my parents, and my grandparents lived in the basement with a few of the kids that were still, my aunts and uncles that were still living at home. And my grandparents' parents lived in the middle of the house. So there was a lot of history. There was a lot of history in one tiny little house. And you know, my granddad was an alcoholic and blah, blah, blah. He worked, he was a grafter, but he would, you know, come home and from the pub, and if the house was cold, you'd hear all the sideboard getting axed, basically, to just stick on the fire, you know, and that would be him, and that was his life. And my dad was like a child of an alcoholic, but without a program. I mean, my dad was very, very bolted together, and he had to be for survival. And my great-granddad was just kind of, I don't know what, he was more interested in, they're still in Islington in the late 50s, and there was horses around. We had a stables, a couple of doors down. And my great-granddad was more interested in horses than people, you know. And so that was the kind of base, that's the backdrop to how I grew up. And we used to go hop picking down in Kent. And this particular year, I think it was about 7 or 8, and I didn't want to go. It was just a real, but my dad said, well, you know, go with Nan because she needs some company, and, you know, and so off the two of us went to pick hops down into Kent, and 3 months in the summer. Now, I got to tell you that my parents gave me quite a lot, and my parents were very loving, and they instilled in me this thing of, I can have you know, that I'm entitled to, I'm entitled to all the things that they never had. So I had an inbuilt thing of, you know, I can have it, I can have life, I can, you know, and, but they never instilled the other half of it that said, if you don't get what you ask for, you'll go to bits, you know, and I never had that bit of me that could deal with any sort of form of rejection. So I go off hot picking with my nan, and I'm in all the 60s fab gear, you know. I weren't doing it for the money. My dad had money, he was a grafter, you know. And I got very friendly with the farmer's daughter. And the farmer approached me, you know, he could see what was going on. He said, look, he was a very terrifying bloke. He'd lost all his fingers in an accident, a hot picking accident. He was like a real huge guy. And he said, I don't want you hanging around with my daughter. And I kind of, okay, you know. And I went off to see my nan. And I said, he doesn't want me to play with his daughter. What's wrong with me? What's all that about? And she didn't know what to say, you know. I looked at her, she looked at me, and I realised, so that was the first time I realised that actually I was on my own here with a resentment, and I didn't know what to do with it. I just did not know what to do with it. No parents around, you know, just me as a kid. And so I thought, well, okay, you know, and I was like any addict kid, I was smart. You know, I've found that out in the rooms, you know, we're smart kids. And I thought, yeah, okay, if I'm gonna get punished for something I didn't do, then I'm gonna do something worth getting punished for. So I slipped back up to the farmhouse and I stole her bicycle. And kind of highly self-Freudian, I suppose. Yeah. I was only 7 or 8, so that really weren't the issue. But, you know. And I pedalled off around the country lanes, and that didn't work. I took the bike back, and my dad had given me a case tenner, put in my little pocket of my Levi's, you know, just in case there was any. So I had that. And I thought, well, the stealing thing ain't worked. And so I went to the local store, Edwards, the local. And he had, in those days, it was, you could buy blackjacks and fruit salads. And he had a few of them on the flash there, and, you know. And I said, well, I'll have them. I'll have that handful. And I said, have you got any more? And he said, well, I've, you know, hold on a minute. And he brought out from the back two boxes, a gross each, that's 144. And he said, well, Al, sonny, how many do you want? You know, and I said, well, I'll have all of them. You know, I could barely lift them, you know. I took the fruit salads and the blackjacks and I just ate them. I just ate them like they were, there was no tomorrow. Till I had all blackjack running down. And I, you know, in a kind of, That was the only way that I knew how to take care of what was going on with me. That was how I knew how to really comfort myself. And that didn't work. And then I'd already watched my granddad go into the pub. I went to the pub the next day on my own in the village. And I ordered a pint of beer. And I was just standing outside the pub, you know, with a pint of beer, and you know, and I started to drink it, and I thought, you know, I said, this is pants, basically, you know, I'm just standing here, drinking a pint of beer, and this is just rubbish, this is a rubbish way of kind of taking care of the situation, and I guess from that day forward, I really started to really desensitize and detach. And But that resentment which I had, is kind of like that, you know, the stuff that comes out the alien in the film The Alien, and it just burns right through the metal and it just keeps going and going and going. Well, that's how I felt a resentment felt to me. It was just burning right through me, and I never picked up with that, and I never stopped it burning right until the fourth and fifth step. I mean, it kept burning in me, and I kept finding different variations on how to sort of cope with it. But so, you know, I had the addict thing from an early age, and I was looking for something outside of myself to take care of it. I didn't use from there, and I didn't pick up drink and just totally fly into it or anything like that. I just, you know, I got into sports and I tried to be normal, and but I think the seed was set in me, and I went back to London, all the fab gear and the long hair and the flowered shirts, it all just all went, basically. And overnight, I got a crop and a big pair of boots, and I completely changed. I flipped, as we can do, from one thing to another overnight. And started getting involved. You know, I was just a kid, but you know, I was started still going to football matches and started. My parents never really bothered to find out. The rule in my family was you don't ask about my business, and I won't ask about yours. They were the rules, and so I kind of got involved in all that late 60s, 70s football violence, basically, and. That kind of took care of business, you know. It fueled a kind of anger in me. It gave me a platform to you know, terrorise people up north, you know, in shopping precincts and all that kind of stuff. And then glam rock came along, and I kind of thought, well, I'll have that, because that's, you know, I don't know if anyone remembers England in 72, but it was a really grey place. And glam rock came along, and it was the answer, you know. And it was, and I thought, yeah, I'm having it, you know. And I started stealing all my clothes down at Bieber's in Kensington. I dressed like a rock star. I mean, I absolutely dressed like a proper rock star. And I got a gig on Top of the Pops, dancing every week for a year. And I mean, I actually looked quite good. You know, I mean, that was the thing. And you know, I was still going to football, and I was still, you know, travelling up and down on intercity trains in gold lamé jackets. I mean, I look properly mental. It's the truth. And I couldn't quite let go of one thing, and I sort of, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it was David Bowie, and it was the Alien, and all that. And I felt that, you know, that's how I felt, you know, that he was plugged right into to me in that respect, you know, that kind of alien thing. And I kind of, you know, I liked the drugs that went with it. And but, you know, like anything like that, it didn't last too long. And I kind of guess after that, I tried to straighten up. You know, my dad asked me to come and work for his company, and I was already, you know, my dad had a construction company. He said, look, you've got to get rid of all the glitter clobber and all that, because because, you know, that's got to go, you know. So I, you know, I started turning up the work on building sites in my slippers and all that, you know. And I would have gone in my pyjamas if I could really have gotten away with it, but I was starting to develop a sort of, I thought it was a spiritual side to me, but it was really, it was just that I'm just too good for everyday life, really. That is what I was cultivating, you know. But I thought, I kind of thought it was spiritual. I thought I was being all just, you know, out there with it. And but I guess I just had a lot of deep-seated resentment that, you know, that everyday life was just not up to scratch. No, and I got an apprenticeship. My dad wanted me to, you know, I had very little in common with my dad, and I thought, well, okay, if I get an apprenticeship in this thing, maybe as a builder we'll have something in common, or, you know, whatever. And I got a job with the council, which I got to tell you, you cannot get fired from. You could not, it was a job for life, son, it's a job for life, you know. It was like that, and, you know. And I was already smoking too much dope, and which kind of stopped me being angry, but it left me very sort of, very spaced out. You know, it was a job that just really didn't agree with me, really. And I started taking acid. I was one of those acid takers. I kind of thought I'd just not, if I took enough of it, I'd punch through to the other side or something. And, you know, I wound up fixing it up. And it must have just smashed my psyche all over the fucking place. And I was trying to do an apprenticeship on a building site, you know, and I was reading far too much, and I got introduced to this drug called Datura, and it was one of those spiritual drugs, you know, that we, and it just plugged me into, it was very powerful, and it plugged me into, I kind of took it and I could almost see into people's souls, but I wasn't morally kind of developed enough to handle it, and all I saw was all the negative stuff in the world, and it was as if David Lynch was filming Hieronymus Bosch or something. It was really fucking mental, and you know, the guy who's giving it to me said you'll be a little bit short-sighted when you wake up the next day. You know. And I woke up completely blind. I mean, I just couldn't see, you know. And I thought, what the fuck, you know. And a couple of hours and my sight just slightly came back. And I sat in bed all day and I had to go to work. By this time, the council were just sending me further and further contracts. They couldn't quite get rid of me, so they were sending me further and further out of London. And I went into work that I could barely see on the bus, but I went in anyway, and I couldn't do anything. I was trying to hammer something, and I couldn't see. I was in a real mess, you know. I was actually in a real mess, and I thought, I know what I'll do. I went to the chemist. It was a bit like the kid going to the sweet shop again. I went to the chemist and I said, "Oh, look, mate, I'm on a building site down here. I'm the medical officer, and what we need a load of surgical spirit and some 2-inch plaster tape. I need some amyl nitrate. I need some cotton wool." And he said, "I remember." He said, "Now hold on a minute." He said, "I don't think I've got any of that 2-inch tape." He said, Marge, he said, bring up that amyl nitrate from the basement, right? And he's brought up this World War II, it must have been, this thing in a wooden case with a load of dust on it. Blew it off, and it was like, it was little amyl nitrate case in wax-proof paper, you know, and he said, how many of them do you want? And I said, save it. I said, well, I want the lot, you know. So off I go, and I'm in the changing rooms on the building site, and I'm getting, what the fuck's that stink? You know, and they found me, you know, out on the scaffold in the afternoon, completely, I mean, I was completely gone, and no boots on, and I got called into the council office on the Monday, and they said, listen, do you want to take early retirement? And I said, what, I'm 18. What are you talking about? No, they said, look, do you want the redundancy money now, or do you want it when you're 65? You know, and I said, yeah, I'll have it when I'm 65. Yeah, of course I'll. I said, no, I'll have the money now. I mean, you know. And that was it. That I took that as that my working life was over. You know, that was a green light for me to say that. That's it. It's all over. I'm retired. It's rubber stamped. I had a couple of years of just really drifting around, and after that, probably taking, you know, too many drugs, and I decided to go. It was the '70s, and I decided to go to India to see the Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh, and I was going to give away all my possessions and what little I had, and I did. I sold my bike and my stereo and. And off I went, and I started to fix up, basically, there. And I don't know if the kid that used to bring the syringe, I think he was getting them from a hospital dump or something, you know. And I got really ill. And I mean, it's one thing to be using in the middle of Camden, and it's just such another thing to be, you know, using in the middle of Bombay. I mean, it's just such a different kettle of fish, and I, all the time I was trying to look for some kind of spiritual person that would really take care of me, you know. And I did manage to get to Pune. I did manage to get there, but I was kind of gone by then, and I stayed 20 minutes. I mean, I went all that way, and I stayed. And I sat in front of an empty chair. I just missed these morning thing. And I was sitting in front of an empty chair, hoping that I would get some sort of resonance from his chair, you know. And it was very, very, very desperate. And I just wandered off. I'll go up to Nepal or somewhere, wherever it was, but the train was so slow going up the hill. I got off the train and started walking. I wound up 6 months later, it must have been, in the middle of the Hindu Kush, basically. I mean, this is where Osama bin Laden's living. It's so remote up there. And I had on a little Harris tweed jacket that I got from an Oxfam shop. No shirt, just my pants. And a pair of sandals that someone had made me out of an old tyre. And I had my passport and a toothbrush and some toothpaste. And that was all I had in the world. And the passport was only if I died. At least someone would know who I was, and my parents could be. I had gotten my world down so small It was just so ridiculously small. And you know, it's funny because there's been an earthquake in exactly that area where I was, and the people were very, very kind to me. They got fuck all, and yet they really looked after me. You know, the kind of the Westerner that had it all and sort of come to their country with nothing, and he still got his hand out. You know, and yet they were constantly giving, and you know, they said, look, man, all the hippies have gone home. It's finished. It's over. You know, it's gone. The era's gone. It's, you know. And I managed to get back. I hitchhiked, basically. I hitchhiked. And when I came back to London, there was very little to live for, basically. And I very quickly got addicted. Very quickly, and there was a big hole in my life, and I filled it with drugs. And that, you know, is the best way that I knew to take care of myself. I can't really see it in any other terms unless I punish myself. You know, that is the best way that I knew, and I became increasingly more anxious and more desperate and more, you know, just, you know, and I kind of wound up. You know, as a flavour, but you know, I'd wake up, I'd have no gear, just some cottons, maybe I'd cook them up, I'd put some alcohol with it, I'd know I'd have an hour, you know, to get out and do something, maybe get some credit. I remember this one time of 4 o'clock in the afternoon, on a Friday, funny enough, no gear, desperate. I found 2 pound doors in a skip, and I know someone that's going to give me 20 quid for those, way across town. And I managed to drag them out of the skip. I don't know how I even carried them, quite honestly. But not only that, but there was a big queue for the bus, and on a Holloway Road, there was about 50 people trying to get on the bus. So, excuse me, straight through, with the 2 big pound doors, right, on the bus. Sorry, mate, you know, I don't have no money. Bus drivers look at me as if it was, oh, for fuck's sake, you know. It's a nutter alert. And, you know, and I plonked the 2 big doors down right in the middle of the aisle where the bus go. Everyone's having to come over the steps. Everyone's moaning, and I'm like, yeah, yeah, but you don't, you know. And then, you know, try and, you know, get my money that way, and then it would be off to, I'd get straightened out for an hour. I had another time of just, you know, late on that Friday night, and then I broke into a squat. I stole a fireplace, a big marble fireplace, and a front door, a big stained glass front door. And this is about sort of 9 o'clock at night. And got to the phone box, phoned up a minicab office. You know, can you send a minicab round? You better make it in a state. And yeah, all right, mate. And he comes around. Oh, it's a guy from school. And I was like, oh no, I hope he don't recognise me. You know, and off we go. I got all this shit in the back of his estate, and we're running round. I know a guy that buys doors, and it's like 11 o'clock at night. I've had to knock him up and get some money off him, and then, you know, and then all this. And just absolute chaos. And as I'm getting out, he said, you don't remember me, do you? He said, listen, I thought I was doing bad just punching a minicab around. He said, but honestly, Brian, you made me feel like a king. You know, because you know you're just living one shit life, mate. I'm telling you. And you know, and I've had to carry all that stuff, all that horrible stuff into recovery. And by the time I got to recovery, the first thing, I went to a meeting and I agreed with everything, and I had my Road to Domestos, and I got it, you know. And then I thought, you know what? You're not going to control me. That's the bottom line. You are not. No one in recovery is going to control me. That's the thing. I will not be controlled. And you know, consequently, I went out for another couple of years, and I had to realise that actually, in essence, no one's in control. Is the thing of it. No one wants to control me. No, it was my knee-jerk reaction to the program. And once I'd got over that, I was away, you know. And and God's will, you know, it was a lovely step for me with my sponsor, Step Three. And he said to me that, you know, God's will is unlimited, and my will is very limited, you know. Yeah, basically, I don't stand a chance of trying to control my using. I don't stand a chance of being a regular, just having it all regular using. I will abuse it, you know. And you know, we are very blessed with our spiritual approach to you know, we're very blessed, and we hear so many different things, and you know. You know, and the classics are the group of druggies and GOD, and then, you know, and you could hear all in one meeting, you know, this group of druggies, that's what it is to me, or somebody, a Gurdjieff and Uspensky, it's grow or die, you know. I once, in the same meeting, and heard someone around Chelsea Way talking about doing 90 nightclubs in 90 days, and GOD was simply get on down. You know, and I thought, you know, well, why not? You know, I mean, anything can go. You know, it's as long as it's not harmful. You know, and if that's what you want to do, you know. So we're very blessed with that whole. You know, we have a broad spectrum of exactly what God is, and it changes all the time. You know, and did my step four and my step five, and started to emerge from my own obscurity. You know, and as I said to my mate Johnny, that you know, I didn't really care about me. And if you'd have asked me what I was doing with my life, I just would have said that I'm holding somebody else's place in the queue. You know, that's really what I'm up to. That's really where I'm at. And since that four and five, I've started to really act in my life, you know. And and step six would be, you know, it's a humble step, and it takes a big person to be humble. And that's been a very painful lesson, you know, that I have to be big enough to trust in God. That God has a plan for me, that the recovery will support me, that people in the rooms will be there for me. That's, you know, I have to be very humble around all that. I have to be humble when I don't get my own way. When I don't, you know, when people don't fit into the little kind of world that I got boxed up, and if you don't toe my party line, you're executed. You know, that's... I have to be humble around all those kind of areas, and I did a formal step seven, and eights and nines, and started to. I honestly believe that the real magic in the program starts happening after step nine, and you know, and it says it somewhere in the book, but we just stopped taking care of the situation, you know, and let the situation go, you know. And there's a step nine, step 11. It's a 9/11, if you want, meditation. And it's a guy who has his kids on a Saturday, and they're driving him nuts, And he comes up with this idea. He takes a magazine. It's a like a map of the world. He cuts it up into pieces. He says, kids, stick that world back together. Off he goes, puts a kettle on, makes a sandwich. He sings out, there'll be hours. 10 minutes later, Dad, we've finished. You know, so he comes back in, map of the world, it's all stuck together. He said, how the hell did you do that? They said, well, there was a picture of a person on the other side, and it was easier to put the person together than the map of the world. And so, you know, and that kind of the meditation that goes with that is that it is easier to put the person together and the world comes together as just as a consequence, rather than doing it the other way around. You know, that if I take care of you, I might get something back, you know. So, and that's that kind of, I try and carry that meditation of 9/11 and constantly stay in tune with myself in a step 10. I find it very difficult to say I'm sorry. I've got better at it since I've, you know, I don't feel so shamed about being wrong. It's been a big one for me. And I have a resistance to meditation and you know, that whole hippie woolly stuff. I try to put sandals on occasion and get all woolly but it's not me, you know. I come from that kind of environment that is, you know, a pram shed is not some form of yoga, you know. It's that's kind of where I come from, you know, and I'm a little bit rigid with that, but I do try. I try to meditate, and I try to not react, and I try to listen to myself, and I try to give it away. I try to give the program away, and addiction has been the making of me. It's the one thing that I didn't. I didn't want to belong here, and you know, it's turned out this is the only place I've ever really felt like I do actually belong. You know, it's a real paradox, and the program is just full of paradox like that. And as long as I'm giving the program away, that's when I'm at my happiest, actually. That's when I feel like there is a real meaning to my life. You know, I'm not particularly driven by success or stardom or you know, my only drive was to destroy myself. That was my drive. And if I have anything that makes me feel alive now, it is actually to connect in a meeting. That is where I feel alive. That's where I feel. And it's very special. And it's here right now. You know, God is now. You know, it's what we say. God is now. And this is where I connect with God. You know, I'm happy. I'm not by nature, in the nature of rock, I'm not a very giving person. But, you know, I can overcome that. I can get past my own nature and actually give things away, you know, and that's just the best feeling. That's the best feeling ever. And I hope I've given something away tonight. That's my wish, and I want to thank you all for listening. Thank you.
Thank you.